Yes. Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Robcast. It feels like it's time for a sermon. This is episode 279, and last episode with Kristen Bell, we got going there towards the end, and I went on this little riff and said something like, that feels like a sermon. So I've been thinking about it all week. And so here we go. I want to give you an image. Actually, it's two images, but they're similar images, but they're vastly different. And the more I've thought about it, this image has actually, it's like etched itself in my psyche. It's based on a passage at the end of the Bible, the end of a letter to the Hebrews. And it's a fairly obscure, over the years, you know, I've been in this game a bit. I haven't heard that many people work with this image, but it's got something. And I realized this week, after I talked about it in the last episode, that it has actually, over the years, become a way I see things. But I've never really talked about it. So I want to give you this image. And once again, anything from the Bible, it's an ancient story. This one's a letter to some people in a time and a place. But in the letter, the writer makes reference to an earlier text and an earlier story and an interpretation of that story, and then gives the people a new image that's similar to that image. See what I mean? There's all sorts of inside baseball on this one. So I'll just pull it apart. And my assumption is that, like me, you'll see all sorts of things lurking there. So in this letter to the Hebrews, at one point, the writer says to this group of people, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what had been commanded. If anything even touches this mountain, it'll be dead. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. Okay, so this is what the writer does. The writer sets up this image of this mountain, and it's a mountain that's burning with fire, darkness, and gloom, right? All you do is throw a ring into that fire, right? Like this, to a trumpet blast or to a voice speaking such words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them. I mean, this mountain, you touch this mountain and it's death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. Then the writer shifts it. Ah, but you have come to a different mountain. You've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Now, perhaps you're twitching right now because you're like, that's just a lot of jibber-jabber jargon something. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so let's acknowledge how foreign this image is of an earlier mountain and then another mountain. And the writer saying, you haven't come to that mountain. You have come to this mountain. But now this is a story, and this writer has loaded the story with all sorts of references that these people, there's all sorts of little winks and nudges and little hints and little things going on in between the words, as we've come to know, because an ancient text was rarely about just coming straight in the front door. Because for many people in the modern world, the way that you speak things is you just say the facts exactly as they are. But in matters of soul, matters of spirit, the things that light you up, you usually, I call it coming in the side door. You need poetry. You need metaphor. You need a song. You need someone to come in sideways, subversively. Maybe it's just a riddle. Maybe it's a joke. But days later, you've realized that joke contained all sorts of truth and it's working on you. It's doing something to you. So here, this writer is speaking to people, and it's the end of the book of Hebrews. So there's a trajectory. There's an unfolding vision for life. This writer has been talking about the cosmic Christ who comes to heal and reconcile everything, everywhere. So it's a big, giant idea that the writer has been building towards. And at the end, there's this, you didn't come to a mountain that terrified you. Oh no, you have come to a new kind of mountain with thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. Oh, so you can go to that mountain if you want, but you haven't come to that mountain. You've come to this mountain. Now, when the writer talks about an earlier mountain, there is a mountain that would have been central to the people who had first received this letter, central to their view of their people's history. The mountain is Mount Sinai, and there are these Hebrew slaves. They're enslaved in Egypt. They're liberated from their slavery, brought out of Egypt, and they're brought in the wilderness and in their wandering to this Mount Sinai. So these are slaves, and these slaves have been liberated, but it's not just that they're no longer owned by the Pharaoh. It's not just that they're free from Egypt. They've been freed for something. So there's a couple different kinds of freedom. There's freedom from. That's freedom from rules, freedom from oppression, freedom from tyranny, freedom from mom and dad's curfew, whatever it is, right? There's an understanding of freedom that's simply you're free from something that was holding you back, that was an obstacle, that was a shackle, that had its boot on your neck. But then freedom from is always in the service. The goal isn't just freedom from. The point is freedom for. You've been freed from that, so you can do something. So you can be something. So you can give some sort of gift. So you can participate in something larger than yourselves. This is why the rebel often struggles when they get what they want. Because the rebel, as an archetype, as a person, as somebody that you knew, as you, right? The rebel struggles sometimes because the rebel gets their energy from being against, right? They can tell you everything that's wrong. They can tell you everything that's oppressive. They can tell you why that's lame. They can tell you why that will break your heart. They can tell you why those people are hypocrites. And so part of the problem sometimes with the rebel is constantly chafing against whatever structure is in power. But if the rebel gets freed from it, well, now you got to actually make something. Now you got to actually build something. Okay, you're free from everything you were railing against all those years. Great, great. You've deconstructed that thing. Well done. Okay, great, fine, nice. And that obviously had a part. But now, what are you going to make, right? What are you going to build? What do you want to create? Where do you want to go? What within you is demanding expression? And you got to follow it. And you got to see what it is. And you got to roll up your sleeves and figure out what this thing is within you. So in this ancient story, these slaves are liberated, but they aren't just liberated from Egypt. They're liberated to do and be something in the world. And so there's this story of these people coming to a mountain where they meet with this God who has liberated them. And the way that this tribe told this story is their God is unlike the other gods because their God is the God of those on the underside, the God of the slave, the God of the oppressed, the God of the underdog. This was a new idea in human consciousness at that point. And they come and they meet with this God in the wilderness because the wilderness, that's technical, that's ancient, that's like basically a technical term for a space that nobody owns. It hasn't been co-opted by any empire or political force. And that's where this divine shows up, in the space that isn't owned by everything, because this divine keeps insisting everything is owned by the divine. And when this divine speaks, when this God speaks, thunder on the mountain, it terrifies everyone. Yeah, it's terrifying. Of course it is. Of course it is. It's brand new. These people have been disempowered slaves. They've been beaten down. They've been robbed of the fullness of life. And now they're being given a new word, and it's a word about their fullness. It's a word about their bigness. This divine wants to make what's called a covenant with them, which is a living, breathing relationship. And actually, Sinai, Mount Sinai, historically was understood as like a wedding covenant, like lovers. So the whole thing undergirding the story is love. Let's come together. And this particular story was always interpreted by the people who told it as a universal story of the divine and the human, the infinite and the finite, that which is boundless, and those who are in these flesh and bone bodies that you and I know to be home. You see what I'm saying? The story was always understood as something particular that was universal. It was these people, but it was all people. This was a story about humans being divided, being invited into the fullness of what it means to be human. And that's only going to happen with love. Actually, Sinai was understood to be like a wedding ceremony, and then the Ten Commandments were understood to be like the wedding vows. Yeah, so it was always understood. That's why the first commandment is you can't have other gods. Like, if we're going to be lovers, then you can't have other lovers. You see that? There's a whole way to read this story. But when the writer of Hebrews tells the story in a particular way, tells the story about how the people responded. They were terrified by this. Yeah, and actually there's a fascinating, okay, I actually have a book in front of me with actual pages. Notice there's this line in Exodus that's just, it's like central to the whole story. And I'm going to turn to it, and I'm going to find it, and it's going to be glorious. Now, in let's go to 19, shall we? Now, notice this. It says, when the people saw the thunder and lightning, this is the divine meeting them on the mountain. When they saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet, and a trumpet, by the way, the Hebrew word is shofar. Anytime you see the word trumpet, it's always the trumpet was to wake you up. So this is very code for the sound that wakes you up to the full calling and destiny of your life. Yeah, it's like the bracing, piercing sound that wakes you from your complacency. You know that trumpet, right? All of a sudden you have that experience and you're like, wait, what am I doing here? What matters? What means stuff? Why do I have all this clutter in my life? Why am I wasting my time doing that? There's something else I'm here to do. Yeah, that's shofar. That's trumpet. Yeah. And they heard the trumpet and they saw the mountain in smoke. They trembled with fear. And here's the line. They stayed at a distance. Yeah, there's a calling on these people to be something new, to step up into the fullness of who they're here to be. And what it says in Exodus is their response to this invitation was, they stayed at a distance, and they said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen. But do not have God speak to us, or we will die. Moses, you do it, not us. They're standing at a distance from the mountain, correct? But they're standing at a distance from themselves. Can't somebody else do it? Do you see what they've done? They split humanity into two groups, Moses and then everybody else. You do it. You have the magic. You're the leader. You're the one. But don't make us step up. There's actually a line in a different spot where Moses says, man, I wish they'd all prophesy. He's tired of being the only one. He's like, I wish they'd all step up to the fullness of who they've called to be. Now, a chapter earlier, there's this line where the divine is speaking to these people, although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Kingdom of priests. So the goal all along is not that there are these two kinds of people, the people who do it, the people who get it, the people who have the magic, the people who have the authority, you know, the superstars, and then everybody else. But the divine vision all along is all of them as a kingdom of priests. It means full authority. It means resting calmly and confidently in the fullness of who they're here to be. A peaceful, beautiful harmony of the divine and the human. But the response to this bigness is it's too much. They can't do it. They tremble, their fears overtake them, and they stand at a distance. They essentially say, who am I to do this? They essentially say, but that's something that somebody like Moses does. They essentially say, none of the neighbors will understand this. What will they say? All of us as priests? That's like a brand new idea. No. Everything's split. You have the people, the big people, and then you have everybody else. The vision here all along was something revolutionary and counterintuitive and totally different, but they stand at a distance. Do you do this? Do you stand at a distance from who you're here to be? Do your fears sit on your shoulder about what people will think? Who are you? Who do you think you are? Isn't that selfish? Isn't that kind of egotistical? Isn't that having too high a view of yourself? Yeah, it's an ancient story. But the thing about these stories isn't that they happen. The point of these stories is that they happen. Yeah, because in the Hebrew telling of these stories, they happen and then they happen. They're true then because they're true now, because they speak to something of the human condition. Because you know it. You have those things within you you're dreaming of. You have those big ideas, those things that sort of float through at the top of the heart. But maybe I could try that. Maybe I could do this. I've seen so-and-so do that, but nah, I could never do that. Then how come I keep wondering? How come I keep thinking about it? If that's not for me, then how come it keeps coming up? Yeah, and then you meet somebody who's doing the thing that you would love to do, and instead of being like, who am I to do this? They just say, yeah, mm-hmm. I listened and then I followed it. Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, you never feel up to it. You never feel worthy. That was never the game you're playing. Something within you says to say yes to this and follow it, or something within you will die. That's how it works. And in this ancient story, they stand at a distance. You haven't come to that mountain, the one that can be touched and is burning with fire to darkness and gloom, to a trumpet blast or a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them. The sight was so terrified that even Moses said, I am trembling with fear. So the writer says, you haven't come to that mountain. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem. So he takes that mountain, takes a different mountain, Jerusalem, and says, you've come to this one. You've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Okay, now let's go back through those, because some of those words are like, what? Here is one way to read it. The writer essentially says, you have stood at a distance long enough. You have told the story of trembling at the foot of the mountain enough. You have failed to listen to the fullness of what the voice is calling you to enough. We're done with that mountain. There's a new mountain. And that mountain, first off, it's thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. Joy. Joy. Yeah. The whole thing works a different way. Here's how it works. You follow the joy. And you follow the joy because joy is always communal. It draws you into something larger than yourself. It makes you feel like you're part of the thing. It makes that lone voice where you feel isolated and like no one gets me. Joy pulls you into, oh yeah, there are lots of us listening for the deep knowing, for the divine voice, for the intuition, for the Christ within us, calling us to the fullness of who we're here to be. And when we listen to that, as opposed to an isolating thing that's sort of centered in the self, it actually brings us into a deep communion. We start reading history and we feel a bond with those who came before us. We run into others who seem to be listening to the same voice. They're no longer letting fear guide them. And suddenly people who we didn't even notice before become like comrades, colleagues, friends. They're like people walking down the path with us. So the new voice is all these different people. And by the way, these sessions that I do, there's no organization to who the people are that I... So each day now, I sit on the front yard under the tree and interact with these different people. And it's an accountant from Alabama, and it's a poet from Massachusetts, and it's an entrepreneur from Nigeria, and it's a beautiful chef from Qatar who has this beautiful message of grace and hope, and then it's a person who owns this business, and it's a person who's just trying to figure out how to read the memoir. There's no commonality, and yet everybody gets together and starts talking about the thing within them that is demanding expression, and suddenly there's thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. That's how it works. Try this with friends. Sit in a circle and say, what is the thing within you that is demanding expression? What is the voice within you and your deepest self? What are you being invited into? Do you have some sense that there could be more to your life? And do you have any sense of what that first step into the more might look like? Try this in a circle of friends and see if you don't begin to find thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You try this. You have a partner. Just say to the partner, where do you want to go? And then your partner says to you, where do you want to go? Yeah. If you could just lay it all out, biggest, widest, most imaginative vision for the next month, 6 months, year, 10 years, what would it be? And then you ask that of the other person. Tell me if you don't find that. Tell me if that joy doesn't begin to emerge. We could. We can even think this. We can express this. We can say this. We could dream about this. We could take like one step to actually having that be where the story goes. Thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. You have come to a mountain, which is the church of the firstborn. Now, the word church is actually an ancient word. That's not like a word, well, church people came up with. You like that one? Church. It's not a word that church people came up with. No. I would argue that the origins of the word church go way, way back. Go back to this very Exodus story. Because there's this old word aid in the Hebrew, which means like witness or to see something unfold. There's a point where God says to Moses, gather together the Adah, essentially the witnessing community. Now, what had they just witnessed? Oh, their liberation. Bring together all of the people who have witnessed their liberation from slavery, because there's something new. It wasn't the grace. The grace wasn't just getting them free from that. The grace was so that they would be free to give themselves to the world, a kingdom of priests. Yeah. So when it says in this text, when it talks about mountains and mountain and the earlier mountain, and then talks about a church of the firstborn, well, firstborn, that was Egypt language. Firstborn was the son of the Pharaoh. Firstborn was a way of speaking of belonging, a way of speaking of inheritance. The firstborn was secure. Because first, and that's ancient language based on all sorts of things that aren't how we organize ourselves in any way now. Nevertheless, the language is loaded because it's essentially saying you are witnessing to your liberation. You're part of that body of humanity. And the church of the firstborn, your worth has never been in question. Whether you're good enough was never the game we were playing. Whether you measure up, no, you've been the people witnessing to your liberation. You're the firstborn. So it's this very poetic, symbolic way of saying at this mountain, in this new mountain we find ourselves at, any voice telling us that we're not worthy, that we're not good enough, that we don't measure up, that we don't have it, that somebody else has something we don't have, please, that's the other mountain. That's a bad interpretation of the other mountain. And you're not even at that mountain, let alone you don't even have to go along with that story. This is the new mountain of the firstborn. This is the thing I see again and again is the second the person stops saying, well, who am I to do this? Or the word often, legitimacy. Or the word often, authority. How about there's this thing. It's taken root within you. It's demanding expression. Something within you is like, I should follow this. Something about my very life is tied up in following this. So you hold it loosely, but you also throw yourself into it. You don't put too much on it. And yet, you know that something about this, something about your curiosity, something about this impulse that is asking you to do something with it, something about it is central to your oxygen, to your life, to your soul. Yeah. Firstborn. Yeah, firstborn. You belong. You've always belonged. You've always been loved. You've always been a daughter. You've always been a son. Yeah. We don't worth what? Measuring up? What? Do you see how even boring those stories are? But who am I to do this? Who am you? Who are not you? Who am not you? Yeah, you've come to a different mountain. You've come to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. Now, this is this ancient idea of like a book of life. So the writer is drawing on all sorts of images from this ancient ways of speaking about these things. If you're concerned that there's some sort of thing that you're not getting into and maybe some other people, okay, it's just sorted. It's just sorted. You're in. Your name. You're good. You're good. You're good. Can we just take all those worries and all those fears, all that out of there? Yeah. Let's just leave that all behind. That's not in play on this mountain. By the way, the people who you most admire, the people who light you up, who show you the way, the people who have inspired you, yeah, think about what it was about them. Think about what it was that moved you. They're not looking over their shoulder. They're not worried that somehow I might get caught. I can't believe I'm getting away with this. No, they're just doing the thing. They're just doing it with joy. And something about that invites you in to the thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. That's why they inspire you. Yeah. That's why you're quoting them. Because something that they said resonated with something within you. It's like they held a mirror up to you. You resonated with that because it's in you. They're like a magnet, and all they did was pull up that shard which was within you. Do you see it? You can read it as, oh, they're so awesome. How could you ever be like that? You could also say, wait, they inspired you because the same thing that you see in them is in you. It may be in a more embryonic, earlier stage, but you're quoting them and you're telling me about them and you're praising them and you're so excited about the thing you saw in them because the same thing is in you. It's an ancient call, a kingdom of priests, everybody stepping in to their fullness. That's why any system that endlessly perpetuates the same hierarchy of the people above who have all the magic, all the power, all the knowledge, all whatever, and then the people below who are just sort of kept in their place, that system is working against the evolutionary arc of the whole project, which is to empower everybody to step in to the fullness of everything we're here to be. Do you see that? So when you come across somebody who seems to be the thing, I could never do that, then why are you so moved by it? Unless what it's saying to you is you have some sort of thing in you. Yeah, and it might be different than that. It might work different than that. It may involve different group people. It may have a different skill set. It may be a different kind of depth and breadth to it. Yeah, of course, it's all going to be different. All the parts are different within the whole. That's what makes it so compelling. You haven't come to that earlier mountain where you stood at a distance. No, you've come to a mountain with thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. Oh, there's this line. You've come to God, the judge of all, to the spirit of the righteous made perfect. Yeah, all that, I'm not good enough. Look at what a mess I made of things. You don't understand my past. It says, wait. Yeah. By the way, this phrase, God, judge of all, if you immediately twitch, like, I don't want a judgmental God. Actually, there's another way to understand judgment. For many people, judgment is condemnation. Judgment is sentencing. Judgment is punishment. But wait. Judgment is simply the making of a decision, the revealing of what has been done. Yeah. See, judgment is exposure. Judgment is the veil being pulled back. Judgment's truth. Yeah. Think of all the energy we spend covering up. Think of all the energy we spend holding down the things that we're mortified about. Oh, I don't want anybody to know about that. Think of all the energy that's spent like avoiding. God, if people could see just what's going on inside of me, if they knew the stuff that I've been a part of back there, right? Think of that energy. Think of how it sort of eats away at the heart. But here's what this says. God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. It says the divine who sees it all, absolute, seamless transparency. You are known in your fullness and loved and embraced exactly as you are. Yeah. See, that's what happens in loving, in love, and in a relationship where there's love. The person is seeing more and more of you, all the stuff that you don't want anybody to see, and they still love you. I know. That's why love and mystery go hand in hand. They see all the parts of you that you're repulsed by, and they still love you. Yeah. So at this mountain we've come to, with thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, we're the firstborn. We've belonged the whole time. In this mountain, everything that most terrifies, mortifies, and embarrasses us is known and exposed. My definition of judgment is turning the bright lights on. The bright lights get turned on and you cannot hide. It's full exposure. It's glaring transparency. And in that, because obviously then, if you've been spending lots of energy trying to cover up, that will be shocking and might have an element of pain. And yet, freedom. The bright lights have been turned on. Everything has been exposed and seen. And this divine love announces that you're fine. I see it all, and you're fine. That's how we move with each other then. We see the fullness of each other, and we embrace and love each other in spite of all that. Sometimes we even love each other more when we see it. We reveal ourselves to each other. We open ourselves up so that others can actually see the stuff that we have, the shame, the embarrassment, all the mistakes, regrets. Yeah, and then we're loved. And the love expands. See, that which we keep within us that we don't show, that we try and hide, it holds us back from love. But then when we reveal it and we're still loved, then the love expands. That's why the divine and human coming together. We're showing each other something divine when we do that. That's why, obviously, all sorts of different women who sit in circles, people who go to recovery meetings, people who walk together, people who, yeah, all sorts of settings where we organize ourselves for this and we come together and we open up our hearts and something happens. We speak the thing we're most terrified to speak, and then we speak it and we find out that we're okay. And not only we're okay, we're loved. Wow, we feel more loved than ever. That's because there's something divine happening. God is love. Yeah. You have not come to that earlier mountain where you stood at a distance from your own life because of your fear, because of it's somebody else is supposed to do it, because you're trembling at the darkness and gloom. Nah, it's a whole new mountain. Then it says, to the Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Just to throw you off at the end there, a bit about blood. Now, here's why this is interesting. This is seriously going way, way back. Because there's an ancient story coming out of a poem about these two brothers, Cain and Abel. And Cain kills Abel, and Abel's blood is on the ground. And Cain's like, what? Am I my brother's keeper? And then God says, man, I get your brother's blood. It's like, was it crying out from the ground? Yeah, so this is the first murder in this telling of things. And this story had a certain symbolic, mythic power because this brother kills his brother and begins an escalation of violence. So that's what violence inherently does. It escalates. Because now there has to be revenge. But revenge can never even the score. Revenge inherently escalates. Somebody says something about you, and it hurts. And so you say something back to them, but you add just a little extra sauce, right? Because you can't even the score. You have to just slightly score more points. Because revenge inevitably escalates. And so in this ancient storytelling, trying to explain how the world is, such as from the very beginning, violence has gathered a head of steam, and it moves from two brothers to nations to massive numbers of people at odds with each other to polarization across the land. Sound familiar? It always escalates. Rhetoric escalates. Division escalates. Isolation escalates. So people are farther apart, unable to see each other. And so at the end of this mountain, when the writer is saying, oh, by the way, this mountain, it's a new kind of covenant. It's a new kind of covenant in which violence is no longer escalating. It's a better kind of blood than the blood of Abel. It speaks a better word, the writer says, than the blood of Abel. It says what happens when you come to see humanity in our fullness and you begin to step in is you're no longer participating in the same cycles of violence. Yeah. Even at the most rudimentary level, you've lost that endless need to put others down, to look over your shoulder, to compare, which does a violence to yourself. You have your path, they have theirs, you're walking together. You see how it's moved the whole way societies organize themselves. It goes from the deepest fears within us about what will someone think if I take the next step, all the way to how we arrange ourselves in our largest possible groupings. It's a different kind of relationship, not built on a trembling, standing at a distance, but on participation, belonging, and love. Yeah, what an image. So you can see in some ways, in any moment, you can simply ask, which mountain am I at right now? Because I just simply choose to live in the new mountain. I'm gonna stay at the new mountain. I'm going to assume there's some sort of joyful assembly and I can participate in it. Which story are you telling? Are you telling the old story? If you have kids, which story are you telling them? Yeah, it's impossible out there. It's really hard out there. Life is really tough. You don't get how tough it is. Or are you telling them a story about thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, where they have always belonged, where their worth is not in question, and they're invited to listen to that voice and follow it wherever it takes them? What kind of world is it? By the way, when people use the word God, think of that word as like a, that word is simply a human way of trying to describe what kind of world we live in. Is it a place of love? Is it a place where there's no meaning? Is it a place that is, to its bones, random? Is it a place of just surface? Just atoms, cells, synapses, processes? Or is there depth, soul, spirit, mystery? What kind of world is it? Is it a fixed, cold world that simply is? Or is it a dynamic, evolving universe that keeps expanding and invites us to expand with it? The two mountains become two fundamental postures for how you enter in to the wonder and awe of your life. The question that haunts so many people: yeah, but if I'm true to who I am, you know, what if it's not good, or what? We don't know. Try it. That's what we're doing here, all of us. All the people that you actually admire and think they haven't figured out, they're just trying it too. They're just giving it a shot at being them. They just moved away from the mountain of fear to the mountain of, I might as well try it. That's what the thousands of thousands of joyful assembly. You know what that mountain's called? Hey, you might as well throw yourself into it and try some things. You're only here for a bit. If you're haunted by your history, if you're haunted by what happened before, the breakup, the betrayal, the mess you made of things, you aren't who you were. See what the writer's doing there? This isn't that story. We're in this story. We're not at that mountain. We're at this mountain. So if you tell me, yeah, but when I tried that before, this is what happened. Yes, it did. I'm with you. And it hurt. Sure. And it was confusing. Of course it was. All the feelings you're feeling about it are completely normal and human, but we're not at that mountain. We're here. So this isn't that. Your history is just that, your history. Own every square inch of it. The parts that were painful, just say it was unbelievably painful. You cried for 6 months. Okay, it's probably a very normal response to the thing that you were in. But this day isn't those 6 months. This mountain isn't that mountain. This relationship isn't that relationship. This idea that you're thinking about trying isn't that idea that you tried. It's different. We're not there. You aren't who you were then. So your history is to be embraced. It's to be acknowledged. Grieve what you got to grieve. Celebrate what there's to celebrate. And then you're at this mountain. So live like you're at this mountain. That's the invitation. Or perhaps you are haunted by this sense of, yeah, but if I'm true to the fullness of who I am, what about others who won't be able to contain my bigness? I will be too much for them. I will upset things too much. I will be a disruptive force. Well, this mountain, this is thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. So anytime I don't do what I do because I am fearful of how others may handle my joy, I have then handed the power of my joy over to others. I have given others the power over my life. Do not hand your power away. Do not hand that to somebody. Yeah, that's why it's thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. You've tapped into that joy. Yeah, so we don't give that power to somebody else. If you haven't even made the thing and you're already worried about the critics, you have given the critics so much power and energy that could be used to actually do whatever it is that has welled up within you that is asking you to do it. Yeah, you see that? Yeah, people are given their power over all the time. You don't need to. You can come to a mountain that's thousands upon thousands of angels of joyful assembly. You don't have to rationalize it, explain. You don't even have to understand it yourself. I stand at a mystery from my Rob Bellness. I find the whole thing terribly mystifying. Why am I so thrilled giving you this sermon like this? I don't know. Why do I come up with this stuff? Why do any of us, why are we drawn to what we're drawn to? Why do you live where you live? You could give me some rational explanations, and at some point, you would stop being able to rationally explain why and how you do what you do. It's something deeper, something level of soul, spirit, something sits on top of the heart. This is pre-verbal, often pre-rational, not irrational, simply pre-rational. Our mind can't keep up sometimes with what soul is inviting us into. Yeah, so what you do is you refuse to stand at a distance from that which is deepest within you. Yeah, they stood at a distance and said, Moses, you interact with the divine, but it's too much. It's too big for us. You haven't come to that mountain. You've come to this mountain where thousands upon thousands of angels have gathered in joyful assembly to like a church of the firstborn who realized they belonged all along, where your name is written so you're no longer wondering if you're worthy or not. What a boring question. It was always boring. I'm bored just thinking about it. You've always belonged. You've always been worthy. Now, what is it that you're here to be? Who is it you're here to be? Yeah. Yeah. You say yes to that. You say yes to this mountain because you have come to this mountain. Yeah. There we are. And may grace and peace be with you, my friends, at this mountain.